Yeah, Jim Love had a garret down South Island. Central Aviation.
Yeah.
And what's his name, flew it. What's his name, Ali? The old guy in Twizel. Flies to Greg Bayliss. He flew the garret.
Oh.
Screaming horrible things.
Yeah.
For lunch, he used to park it halfway down the airstrip facing the other way. Walk back up the airstrip and have lunch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I caught up with him the other day. He's, that was when I was with Super Air, and because he's the opposition, and we happened to be working just off his, just out of town there, but he, nice chap, never met him before, but I know plenty of him. He's in that.
Gentleman.
Yeah, he is, really is.
Yes.
He came and sat with us most of the day. I think we had a cup of tea together, and he helped shovel the last 10 ton.
It was the opposition.
Yeah. Good
that
fella.
Like him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he
nice
flew Mount Cook Porters for a while.
Oh, yeah.
So when he flies like he's got a bunch of tourists around, just gentle and nice on the aeroplane.
Yeah. There's quite a bit of footage of him with that, the super pilots.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Thingamabob.
I think.
I really need an extra microphone so I could get you in as well, Alison.
No, it's okay.
You could be the fact checker.
No.
I don't even know how I could turn this around.
Geez, you got some gear there.
Yeah, well, I figured might as well, rather than buy something cheap and then later on expand into something a bit better, just get the good stuff straight away, and then it's all done. But Neville Worsley yesterday, he was the guinea pig. He's the first one I tried it out on, so seemed to work.
Yes,
tap tap tap, it's all working as far as I can tell. They're little flashing lights and stuff. Yeah, but I don't even have a real subject to talk about. I just like talking about your life or other people's life and what they've done. I know you enjoy talking about what other people have done, but it's an interesting one. Because I grew up in Bulls there, when I was about 8 or 9, I first, the thing that got me into top dressing was a little yellow biplane that used to fly past on weekends. I'd see it out my mate's window.
Yeah, that'd be back in the days of the radio.
It could well have been,
First egg had it, a 450 Pratt.
Oh, yeah.
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 Then years later, we changed over.
Yeah.
I bought a new 600 horsepower radio. Then we bought a kit and put a turbine in the front of it.
Right.
The Dash 20.
Oh, so it was a conversion.
It was a conversion. SJA.
Yeah.
My three daughters, Christian names, Sarah, Julie, and Alison.
Oh.
Yes.
That's nice. What was the horsepower difference going from the radial to
The radial was a 600, and the first turbine was a Dash 20, which was around about 600 as well. But instead of having 100 horsepower drag on the radial, he had a pointed nose.
Yeah.
So, of course, it made the aeroplane go a hell of a lot better.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. But, yeah, that would have been... You used to do work off the Ahakia, and that would have been on weekends.
Yes.
Which would have been when
it never sprayed off there. It was only fertiliser, dry fert.
And they
allowed us to work it at Saturdays and Sundays.
Right.
Mm.
I think it was out towards... this is towards Santoft Way, so you would have been, what's that, west of Bulls?
Yes.
Heading down
Flockhouse Road.
Yeah, around
Dairy farms down around Flockhouse area.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there weren't any farm strips because it was
flat? Wet. It was all winter time.
Oh, okay.
So all the strips were too wet.
Yeah.
Yes. So that's why we used the Ahakia.
Yeah.
And there was 150 acres of concrete there owned by the people in New Zealand.
Yeah.
So it was a...
It was doing nothing over the weekend, so you might as well make the most of it.
Yes.
Get your value out of it.
Yeah.
That's cool. Where did you learn to fly?
Palmerston North of the Aero Club.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. No, my first association with aeroplanes was down on my father's farm, about 10 miles south of here at a place called Rangiotu, halfway between Palmerston and Foxton. And an ag pilot used to turn up there and spray initially in a tiger moth. Then he changed over to an Oster, AOB, I think was the registration. And that was Frank Desborough. He was an Englishman who came out here engineering in the hangar for Manawatu 2 Aerial. And so 1 year I was there and managed to talk myself into going for a ride with him in the Oster, being a two-seater. And never forgot the feeling of spraying across the top of lupins at 6 feet. I thought, well, that's got to be me. So I was very keen on learning to fly, so I had my first lesson. I think when I was about 15 years old, that'd be correct, in 1959, out here at the Aero Club, flying champions. The Middle District's Aero Club had about three of them.
How many horsepower were those?
90 horsepower, if I'm correct.
Are they like a cub?
Yes, like a cub. Yeah. Yes, high wing. And BVF is still going. It's owned by a guy in Fielding. And it's still operational. And I actually flew it when the last owner, previous owner, Russell Giles, passed away. The family got me to go out there and jump in it and fly back to Fielding for the new owner, who was Russell's brother-in-law.
Hmm.
So that was memory, sort of a gap of 50 or 60 years.
Yeah.
Flying the same aeroplane again.
Wow.
So then I was still at Boys High School, in Palmerston North Boys High School. And I left there in 1963. I was pretty good at athletics, hard to believe when you look at me now. I was in the high jumping, and I left school after the Manawatu inter-secondary school sports on one weekend. So I came back to school on the Monday morning so that I could prove that I was still at school when the athletic sports took place. And then 8 o'clock on Tuesday morning, I started working in the hangar for Manawatu Aerial. So I had a 0 days turnover from school to working in this industry.
Wow.
And now, 59 years later, I'm still involved in it.
Yeah.
So I worked in the hangar for a few months, and then a vacancy came up as a loader driver. So I went loader driving in a Nuffield, open cockpit, Nuffield, no protection around, and loading a Cessna 180 with the pilot Brian Snell, who was at Palmerston North. He had been through a wings course at Ahakia.
Yeah.
Then towards the end of the year, in September, I think it was, I went to the Whanganui Commercial Pilot School, September through to November, passed all my five subjects, just being fresh out of school. A lot of the other guys were sort of 5 or 6 years older, and they'd been away from school and studying, so it gave me a bit of an advantage.
Had the edge. Was that the Derek Balcom?
Yeah, Derek Balcom ran Derek that Balcom. Course.
Yeah.
He had been with the Aero Club, and then he went with the Rural, and he was a guy that initially got the Beaver going into New Zealand, recommended to Miles King that they buy a Beaver. So Derek did the initial flying and that. And then he changed back to the Aero Club and started running the old commercial pilot school before he went to the ag training school.
Yeah. Have you seen that video that's that they did back then? They were, you know, they were showcasing
the... Yes, I did. I've seen that.
Was it just as busy then? Because they've got the control tower at Whanganui there, obviously. Yes. So it was a controlled...
Very busy.
Yeah.
The Whanganui Commercial Pilot School was probably the school in New Zealand for training commercial pilots.
Right.
There was the Whanganui Commercial Pilot School and the Auckland Aero Club Commercial Pilot School.
Oh, so Air New Zealand bound fellas started there too? Is that what you mean?
No, it was just the Auckland Aero Club for training commercial pilots.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was when those two aero clubs got authority from CAA to reduce the commercial hours from 200 hours to 150. So it made economic sense to go to those specialised school.
How'd they manage that?
Just told a good story about how they had specialised training. And it was I remember doing the flying there at Whanganui. And it was a very, very high standard, the training.
Yeah.
And most guys, they had almost 100% pass rate on those two commercial pilot schools.
Yeah, right.
So I was only 18 years old when I went onto that course at Whanganui.
How long
What was the whole
time? 4 months, 2 months ground course and 2 months flying course.
So 150 hours in 2 months?
No, I'd already done 50 hours for a PP here in Palmerston on the Champion.
Yeah.
With Brian Milne, was a CFI back in those days.
So 100 hours in 2 months?
100 hours in 2 months.
How'd that go with you? That seems... Oh,
loving it.
You are, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That'd entail, I'm trying to do the math in my head, because that's a...
Cessna 150s we were flying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'd be a good couple of hours a day.
Yes, yes.
On average, especially now, when I was at fielding here, they'd try and limit us to half an hour or, one flight a day, and you get itchy feet.
Yes.
Go and do lessons.
Quite a few notable aviators are on that course with us. Bill Black was sitting just in front of me. John Eureka, who had a career in ag flying,
yeah.
He was there. Ken Chambers, who flew James Aviation later on and just passed away in Kaikoura there a few months back. He ended up with a motel.
Yeah.
And then there was a bunch of Australians. There was Eric Andrews, who was a Kiwi from Nelson. He went back to Australia ag flying. Max Polglaze, who was, his notable feat that he did was drive a truck from Orange to Western Australia to recover a Cessna 172 and got back a week or 2 weeks later.
Holy.
And I saw it the other day on FaceTime, where he recounted the expedition to go and pick up that 172 from out back in Port Hedland around that area.
Yeah.
And Peter Hazelton, he was a nephew of Max Hazelton, very well known Australian ag and airline.
Was that one of the books you were showing?
Yes, one of the books I had here, Jim's book.
Yeah.
It was well known to New Zealanders, ferried quite a few aeroplanes out here.
Yeah.
Bought the Beaver BBX back and took the Dromeda back that, what's his name, from Blenheim-owned, Ray Patchett. When Ray finished up working and he flew it back to Australia. So he was still ferry flying around the world at 80 years old.
Good
evening. And just trying to think the other guys. Oh, Jack Butoff, he was on our course. Remember Jack, he sort of stood out. He was 35 years old and all us young jokers wondered why when you got to 35 you'd bother going flying. And then he went ag flying in Wairoa and had a very successful career up there, being a local of Wairoa back in the Bill Cookson days.
Yeah.
Used to entertain us with telling us Bill Cookson stories. Bill Cookson was a Lancaster pilot, Second World War over Germany. So he had lots of stories to recount to the young fellows up in Wairoa. And Jack used to pass those stories on to us.
Cool. Any good ones that you can remember?
No, there is a few, but I couldn't repeat them.
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
Yeah. Man, that's cool. So Beric Dalcombe, did he do all of the flying with you? He was your instructor?
No, he did all the ground lecturing.
Yeah.
And then the flying was done mainly with Ian Foley. He was the instructor there who also did the spraying in the Aero Club's Piper Cub. They had a Piper Cub rig for aerial spraying. And Ian Foley did quite a bit of that together with a guy called Ted Wilkinson, was the other spray pilot, who later on, or before that, I can't remember which order, flew out of Paiatua in a Fletcher for Wanganui Aeroworks. And then when he went on from ag flying, he went and flew for Fiji Airways, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just in the days when Alexander Helicopter was starting up, flying Hillers off Wanganui, together with a Piper Cub that they had spraying.
Yeah.
And that was flown by Ian Wakeling.
Oh, yeah.
Before he converted onto Hillers.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw quite a bit of him when I was in Wanganui. He's still chugging away doing lessons. This is going back 10 years now. But
a year ago or something, I attended his, I think, 60 years of aviation celebration they had for him.
Wow.
Yeah. And then after I finished that course in about December, I finished up getting a flight test with Maurie Cooper from CAA, then came back to fielding and went loader driving for a couple of months and then went back to Wanganui again and went on Beric Dalcombe's ag training school. By that time, he'd given up the instructing and lecturing at the Aero Club and got a 180, and I was on his second ag training school with a Jugger Wright from Airwork. I forget his first name now. And we did, I think, 40 or 50 hours in a 180.
Yeah, okay.
And Berwick, being a fairly dominating personality, Second World War, mosquito pilot, pathfinder over Germany, he was our instructor. So what he told you to do, you did. And never ever forgot those principles. I think all of us who went through Berwick School never forgot what he taught us.
Yeah.
Invaluable.
Yeah, right. Well, were there any main parts out of that in particular that you thought were the most valuable and worth?
I think just setting up a routine and just following it all the time.
Yeah.
When you came downwind, where you turned into, and if the tailwind got up, you went a bit further downwind, all those sort of things. Just set up a routine and just kept it planned.
Yeah.
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 No, he was very, very good, and I valued it. And that was on the second course, I think. I can't remember. I think Peter Meek was on the first one and Graham Millwood from Manor 2. Peter Meek was here from rural.
Yeah, right.
And then we were on the second course with that fellow Wright and myself.
Yeah, so only a half dozen or so of you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I don't know how many courses he had, but he had quite a few. Put quite a few through there in the next 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, yeah. And so what was the progression on your training like? I can only compare it to what I know. We had to do 20 hours of circuits where you go start doing low level, just circuits and nothing more. Then downwind circuits and dumbbell landings. And
yes, no, it was pretty well exactly the same. Just with the airstrip marked out with bamboo or pampas sticks.
Yeah.
Defining the width of the runway and the length of it. I remember one thing that he taught us was no sense standing on the brakes and giving it full power and releasing. Didn't gain anything by doing that. Stand on the end of the strip and gradually open the power up. Like being in a boat, you don't sit at the wharf and give it full power and the propeller cavitating. You don't do that when you're on a short airstrip ag flying.
Yeah.
No hurry to get the power into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, just about discipline and doing everything the same.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So we finished that in April. And then a vacancy came up with Manawa 2 in fielding, so I came back there and started top dressing in a Cessna 180 BEL. It had a long career in New Zealand until it came to grief down in South Island on the west coast 3 or 4 years ago, and that was the end of it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. There was a little incident with BEL, Basil Forster Pratt, who then owned Manawa 2 Aerial. Bought the wreck of the 180 BEL that had been tipped upside down on Wairoa Aerodrome by Don Thorpe. And Basil, being a bit of an inventive sort of a guy, arranged to pick it up by the New Zealand Rail, put it onto a wagon at Wairoa, and then arranged for it to stop opposite the Fielding Aerodrome at the crossing there. And the engineers went from the hangar out to the railway line, unroped the 180 and bought the wings and fuselage ashore and fielding.
Yeah.
Put it in the hangar, and that's how it arrived at fielding. And then got rebuilt and then put a hopper in it, and I went top dressing it.
Yeah.
On the, I think it was 21st of April, 1964. My first top dressing job.
Wow. Do you remember it?
I remember it very clearly.
Yeah.
Jacob Elvines up Marquino Road. It was a 21-ton job, and then the second job was 200-ton of lime. And it had Ian McPherson, who was an ex-vampire pilot.
He's done a book?
I don't think so. He's in the top dresser's book, of course.
Yeah.
And he top-dressed with Manawa 2 Aerial for quite a few years, and then became ops manager. So he came out and kept an eye on me.
Yeah.
So here you are with an ex vampire pilot, making sure you look after yourself.
Yeah.
And don't do anything you shouldn't do. So that was the beginning of my career in 1964.
Yeah. How long did the 20 ton take you? So what load can the 180 cut?
180 was legal for about 800 weight, which is about 400 kgs.
Yeah.
But they always carried about 500 kgs.
Right.
Back in the good old days.
And that was that a noticeable difference handling-wise? Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a full load was 1,000 weight, which was a good load for a 180. But quite often on a short airstrip and tailwind, you download to, back in those days, talking English, 900 weight.
Yeah.
Or back down to 800 weight.
Yeah. Were the signals the same? One up is 100 weight?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then sideways like that for refueling. Refuel. Next load to refuel.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So what's the math on that? 20 ton, 500 kilos, so 40 loads.
40
so that,
loads. Yes. And if I remember right, I averaged in my first 2 months 7.7 ton per hour at the 180.
So not bad.
3 or 4 minute turnarounds.
Yeah.
Yes. It means your runs are fairly short because you only had half a ton to get rid of. Yeah. Then I went on to the 185. The 185 was 8.5 tons per hour. And then later on, I went to the Cessna Ag Wagon and we averaged 10.5 ton per hour.
Yeah.
So the Ag Wagon was quite an improvement.
Yeah.
We used to look lovingly and enviously at the people flying Beavers on the East Coast and they were carrying 1 ton. And that was considered to be a very big load.
Yeah.
Didn't need many 1 ton aeroplanes, but the way things have turned out now, 2 tons are standard.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But the 180 was a very good aeroplane for the top dressing industry in that you had a cabin aeroplane carry a loader driver around very easily, which is why Kiwis never went to Stearman's or the American type ag aeroplanes because they were strictly just a single seater.
Yeah.
In New Zealand, you have partly completed jobs and, of course, you had to bring your loader driver home and then take him out to work in the morning.
Yeah.
So the 180 was a big step up, of course, from the Tiger Moth and the Oster and those sort of aeroplanes that the industry was using prior to the arrival of the 180.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, a lot of I've never flown the 180 or the 185, but a lot of friends have, and they all reckon the 180 is a bit smoother to fly or a bit lighter on the hands or something. What would you say to that?
Yeah, lots of discussion on this. As to what a lot of people ran down the 185, but it was only that the New Zealand agent was a little bit ambitious in what load the 185 could carry. 180 had a 1,000 weight hopper, and they advertised the 185 as carrying 50% more. So they put a 1,500 weight hopper in it, and only went up 25 or 30 horsepower, same wing area, so it just wasn't going to work.
Yeah, okay.
Whereas the Australians put fiberglass hoppers into 180, later model 180s, and put a 1,300 weight hopper in it, which would have been good. Or if that 185 in New Zealand, if the 300 horsepower engine had been available, that would have made a colossal difference.
Yeah, right.
That would have been almost as good as an ag wagon.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you wouldn't have needed any more wing area, you just wanted more horsepower.
Yeah.
Whereas carrying 1,500 weight was
too
much, and you could get about 1,700 weight of linemen, which occasionally they were known to carry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What, so was the 180 235 horsepower, is that right?
230, I think.
230.
Those earlier model engines were.
And then the 185 was
260.
260.
So you're only going up 30 horsepower.
Yeah.
And trying to carry another 50%.
Yeah, okay.
It was just getting a little bit greedy.
Yeah. And they were used quite extensively in both types on top dressing, is that right?
Yeah, very extensively. As I say, prior to there we had Tiger Moss, which is the most terrible ag aircraft ever invented.
Yeah.
It had no brakes and no steering tail wheel.
Yeah.
And about 130 horsepower.
Yeah.
Beyond belief how the Kiwis used it, whereas the Americans were using Stearman's, brakes, steering tail wheel, up to 450 horsepower. They're using N3Ns, they're using Wacos.
Yeah.
But of course, because of the English influence in CIA, the Tiger Moth had the paperwork and the Stearman didn't.
Right.
Even though it was built massively strong.
Yeah.
They couldn't get them certified.
Yeah, and they used quite a quite a large number of people just to operate a Tiger Moth, like the wing, the fella on the wing to help turn it around.
To catch it.
To catch it. To two people, one to drive the loader, another to hold the sock to put it in the hopper, and then half a dozen farm hands to unload the sacks into the barrel.
Yes. So, amazingly cool. Amazing the amount of work those fellas got going.
Yeah.
I always, when I was young and learning to top dress there in fielding, they told the story about Don Thorpe when he was flying for aerial farming. 1 year out of fielding, did 1,000 hours top dressing in the Tiger Moth, which is an incredible effort.
Far out.
Although they could keep working in cross winds because they just land across the strip.
Yeah.
Still keep operating.
Yeah. Have you ever flown one?
No, I missed out by about a year when I started in the industry.
Yeah.
Manawatu Two Aerial had just taken over Aerial Spraying Limited, which was Frank Desra's business, and he had a Tiger Moth, BJH. And Peter Anderson took over their first year when Frank sold out to Manawatu Two, and he sprayed in that, and then I turned up, took over from Peter on the spraying. By that time they had spray gear and BEL, so I missed out on being a Tiger Moth pilot by about a year.
Yeah.
Which is probably... was a godsend anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And how long were you in those ones before you shifted on from the 180s and 185s?
I did 1 or 2 years spraying in the 180, which was a bit of a drag with the spray booms on. When I compare it to the way aeroplanes perform now, I know if you took off from fielding and went to the north to spray, when you got up to Ituna West, Stormy Point, you had to do a circuit to get high over the hill, whereas in a modern ag aeroplane you'd probably be 2,000 or 3,000 feet if you wanted to.
Yeah.
So the difference is just quite colossal in performance.
Yeah. Did you take a lighter load on spraying anyway?
Oh no, because you're going and long hauling it, you want to do as many acres as you could, so you tend to put a decent load in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, even with that, did you going from top dressing to spraying, did you have to have any conversion to be able to do that? Was that all part of
appearance? In those days, very little conversion.
Yeah.
I remember Basil, I shouldn't say it probably, but he said to Peter Anderson, you better train this Jugger Griffin in spraying. And Peter said, oh, it's the same as top dressing. All you do is fly low.
Right.
Which is basically the difference. I went down to my neighbour's place, the Jugger Martanger, and sprayed his farm in front of my father's farm, and that was my first spray job.
Right. Was that just water or was it actually?
No, with loading.
So you're...
I'd been and done one load with Peter Anderson. He showed me how to fly low, and then went down. Then the next load was myself flying solo, spraying, and that was it, beginning of a spraying career.
Yeah.
Since then, all the hours I've done, probably 90%, 95% has been spraying.
Yeah. Wow.
When I look back, I haven't done much top dressing. It was just those first 2 or 3 years. And then I've been to Australia at different times doing seasonal top dressing work.
Yeah.
But most of it's 90-95% on spray work.
Yeah. Was your rating, if you call it that, accurate? It's just the same as top dressing, only you fly lower? Your spray rating. How you're saying, your joker just told you it's the same as top dressing, but you just fly lower. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I'd agree with that, although you've got to be very careful because you're down in amongst the wires.
Yeah.
With top dressing, unless there's high tension power lines around, the wires are not a problem because you're up about 70 feet and power lines are sort of, 20 feet. So theoretically you're flying above it. But on spraying, you're down in amongst all the obstructions.
Yeah.
Trees and water pump pipes and power lines, electric fence lines.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you have any early, what would you call them, early learnings or any early frights, scares?
No, not so much. Probably halfway through my career, I had a bad power line strike.
Oh, okay.
In the AirCat, but because it was an AirCat, I got away with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've forever been thankful to AirCat design since then.
Yeah, because it all folds up around you, absorbs.
Does that top wing protects you in a rollover?
Yeah.
No, they are. But still, you don't try not to have an accident because accidents cost you a lot of money for the operator.
Yeah, that's right. We were talking about that earlier, and loads and what have you.
Yeah, you do anything to prevent an accident.
Yeah. So do you think you, looking back on those early days, were you lucky? Were you just, you were taking things carefully, that you didn't have any hard learnings or close fights?
Didn't really work on luck. You just, it's got to be planning.
Yeah.
Thinking about the job. When you're young, you apply yourself 100% to the job, so you are relatively safe.
Yeah.
Plus you've got heaps of energy. You want to do big hours. The more hours you can do, the better.
Yeah. And, of course, that was kind of encouraged, from what I understand. You do, you know, the good pilots do the big hours and the big jobs. And
yes. Luckily, I worked for Basil Forster Pratt, and he was never an operator to push a pilot. Not one little tiny push to do more hours or cart bigger loads.
Yeah.
He just wanted a pilot to go out and do a fair day's work.
Yeah.
So I probably worked for one of the better operators you'd ever work for.
Yeah.
Whereas you heard stories about other companies encouraging pilots to do bigger hours and stay out till it was dark, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I worked in an atmosphere where you did what was comfortable.
Yeah, it's interesting that, because I think when I started, it's not long, I know, but my ag flying, I've really only worked for companies that said the same thing. I've never once been asked what I've been carrying or I should have been carrying more, I think makes a huge difference when some of my mates were getting told the opposite. You know, why aren't you carting this? Or if it's too windy and they want to come home, and they're told to tighten up their seatbelts and carry on, sort of thing, which is, it's a bit crazy to think about.
I remember years ago, after there'd been a series of accidents back in the 70s, I imagine, they had that inquiry into aerial top dressing safety. And it went on for weeks and weeks in Auckland. And there was a lot of pilots gave evidence there that they were forced to work long hours and cart bigger loads, that sort of thing. Mm. But I never ever came across that attitude.
Oh, that's good.
Mm.
Clearly serving you well, you're
doing all right. Yeah.
And so what was your next aircraft after the 180s, 185s?
And then the ag wagon.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you wouldn't believe it, I turned over to the dark side about 1972, I think it was, when I changed over to helicopter flying.
Oh.
There was a big swing to helicopters for spraying, and we had a lot of competitors around us, so Basil and I decided that we'd go and buy a U-300. So I went up to Auckland, did a helicopter rating with Boyce Barrow. Marine helicopters.
Yeah. What did that entail?
About 40 or 50 hours then, if I remember right. You just got a use 300 rating. You didn't get a separate helicopter rating. So I did 40 or 50 hours with Boyce. That was very valuable, very enjoyable. The other pilot at the same time was Jeff Sayers from Air Contracts in Masterton. And then Manawatu bought a brand new 300. And I came back and went flying, spraying for about 10 years in a 300 and did 8,500 hours in the U-300, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
So a bit of a toy helicopter in this day and age, but I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And did a little bit in a U-500, which was a hot rod, and the Bell Jet Ranger, which is a beautiful old man's helicopter.
Yeah.
Beautifully built, lovely, enjoyable to fly. And a little wee bit in a Hiller, Piston Hiller, and then also in a Saloy Hiller. It was an impressive, with a Allison engine in it.
Yeah.
And that performed extremely well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and was then, there a few extra donkeys inside that as well?
Yeah, and being lightweight, being a turbine, went a lot better than the piston.
Yeah, okay.
And then by that time I arrived, virtually the time when I formed my own company. And operated a U-300 for a little while, for a couple of years.
Yeah. When was that? Which year did you start? Oh,
around about 81, I think it was.
Right.
So my company's been going 42 years now.
Yeah. The same Griffin Air Gear.
Same Griffin Air Gear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't realise
Quite matching Alan Beck's 50 years with Beck Helicopters.
Yeah.
That he had there a few weeks back.
Yeah, he did. Yeah,
which is a great effort.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you're slowly catching up anyway.
Yeah. And then our next major move was the call of fixed wings. I respect helicopters. They do a great job and do a lot of jobs that no other form of machinery can do in the world. But the call of going back to fixed wings won over. And I went and bought myself an AgCat.
Yeah.
I must admit, for spray work, I do enjoy flying fixed wing. Sort of feel the aeroplane on takeoff and landing and turning, where a helicopter is more of a mechanical machine.
Right.
You don't get the feeling of the air running over the control surfaces.
Oh, okay.
Or that part of it. So that's what drew me back to fixed wing.
Yeah. And have you done any rotary stuff since?
Yeah, one time I had my AgCat out with a problem on the Walter engine. So I went back to flying a US-300, gap of about 28 years.
Yeah.
I think it took me about 4 or 5 hours to feel happy again, but came back to me, you don't forget it really.
Yeah.
And then we just progressed on the fixed wing side of things.
Yeah.
Went from the 450 AgCat to a 600 AgCat, and then bought a Pawnee to go, took on Colin Sutherland to fly the top dressing work. Went from the Pawnee to a Beaver, which back in the Piston days, that's the ultimate ag machine.
Yeah.
And
I've never heard anyone say anything bad about the Beaver. Actually, until yesterday, I told you, I caught up with Neville Worsley, and he said the one gripe, if he would have one, is the flaps, the pump flaps, and the I'm not sure.
Selector.
The selector.
Selector, yes.
Yeah, I think he said it caught him out one day, and that was his only gripe, if any. He said he actually hasn't got any. He loves the plane.
Yes.
I don't want to make it look like he doesn't like the Beaver, which he does. He loves it. But, yeah, I thought that's interesting. There's not many planes out there that everyone is just in love with it.
Now, that selector problem, they did overcome that by putting the bike grip on the end of the flap pumping handle. So if you grab the handle and pump it, the flaps go down.
Yeah.
If you want to retract, you pull the bike grip.
Oh,
bicycle grip, and that swaps the flow over the other way, and you retract the flaps. There was a bad accident in the wire wrapper from the pilot having the selector going the wrong way.
Mm.
He arrived at the end of the strip to pump flap down, and he retracted the flap and went through the fence.
Yeah.
So after that, they brought out that modification.
Right.
Airwork in Christchurch come out with their own mod, which was a twist grip on the end of the flap handle. So if you had it round to the left, you pump them down. If you wanted flaps up, you rotated it to the right.
Yeah.
And pump the handle.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Can we go back to the chopper stuff? Because I'm interested in that. I didn't realise you'd done any chopper things. Was that all on the flats all around here?
All on, yeah. In the flats here, spraying here, but also in the hill country, north of Fielding, and also quite a bit on the east coast, out on the coastline, spraying in the hill country over there.
Yeah. Good fun?
Yes, spraying's always good fun because you're low down.
Yeah.
And some of that work was probably a bit easier in the helicopter than a fixed wing.
How so?
What's that?
How was it easier? Like in what way? Like the aircraft would perform, the chopper
would
perform?
Well, a helicopter, you can fly up a gully and turn around.
Yeah.
No matter how narrow the gully is.
Yeah.
With a fixed wing, you've got to make sure there's enough speed to get out the top of the gully or turn around.
Yeah.
Wide enough to turn around.
Yeah.
So a lot of planning before you do the job.
Yeah. Because if they...
There you go.
I've never done choppers, so I don't know, but that's why I'm fascinated by them. Is it right? Because someone told me if you can get off the ground or if you can get up and hover, then you should be able to fly your whole load. Is that kind of the simplest way of putting it?
Yeah, I'd say that's roughly right, yes.
Yeah, whereas fixed wing...
You've got to plan the whole time.
Yeah.
You know? Don't want to get up a gully and you can't climb out the top or you can't turn.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a real bad day.
Yeah.
But again, that's when we changed over to turbines. Made a colossal difference performance-wise.
Yeah.
Where you could spray from the old radial. You've got to remember that 1340 out the front of an AgCat, it's got 100 horsepower of drag because of the flat surface.
Yeah.
So you minus 100 horsepower before you start.
Yeah.
So you've got to be really careful with those radials.
Yeah.
They are super good, a radio for cooling because the whole engine's cooled.
Yeah.
But
and they sound very nice.
They sound beautiful. Nothing like it.
Definitely.
I remember years ago we were both top dressing, Mike Cronin and myself. Mike was in the Beaver 450 Pratt and I was in the Aircat 600. And we were working up the pong in a valley above Ashurst. And all the neighbours said the noise was just unbelievable.
Yeah. Be the same with the DC-3s buzzing around.
Yes.
I don't think there was... There's only Jim Frogley's that's been the only radio flying lately that I would know of. And even that was going back a couple of years now.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've got still got AZB that we don't use it for top dressing anymore. It's still got the hopper in.
Yeah.
Just for going to air shows. I haven't had it flying for a couple of years, but we'll get it flying again.
Yeah, nice.
And that'll be the only machine in the world with a hopper in it still.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I keep it in the hopper in there for sentimental reasons.
Yeah. So it could do another load, isn't it? Set up, obviously not going to.
No, I remember after I'd flown turbines for 2 or 3 years and I bought AZB, the Beaver, back from Australia and a 20-ton job came up, so I thought I'd pop out in the old Beaver and do it for old time's sake. It was hard work.
Right.
Yeah, quite incredible how you had to pre-plan in those early days to get lift off a face on the way out, all that thing, whereas a turbine aeroplane, where you point it, that's where it goes.
Yeah. Yeah, the powerhouses these days.
They are.
Yeah.
It's a bit, not unfair, but easy for these young jokers who learn to fly in turbines.
Yeah.
They haven't done the hard yards.
Yeah. Do you think it should be necessary to do some of this?
Don't know. It's a debate, that, as to whether you should start off in a piston engine aeroplane and do the hard yards and then go onto a turbine.
Yeah.
I don't think I've observed a young joker around here who learnt about 3 years ago straight off in a Cresco, and he did it very well and ended up very capable pilot, so I think it's okay.
Yeah.
One friend of mine a while ago said if he ever became director of CAA, he'd pass a rule saying that you couldn't fly a turbine aeroplane until you'd done 10,000 hours on a piston to make them appreciate what they got.
Yeah. Okay. I've got a ways to go then.
Yeah. Well, there is young pilots now who will never fly a piston.
Yeah, that's right.
Just straight into a turbine.
Yeah. But I guess it could just easily be, and probably is, more the person rather than the person in the plane.
Yes,
if that makes sense. Operators are a lot more choosy who's going to fly their aircraft because they're not a dime a dozen now.
Yes.
To fly these planes, it costs a lot more and there's a lot more riding on it.
No.
So they're going to be a bit more picky about who they choose to fly it. And if they're bringing a new fella up, they're probably less inclined to pick a cowboy.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, you look, if you parallel it with trucks, jokers learn to drive in a Mercedes automatic truck now. They don't go and start in a J3 Bedford or whatever, the old gear.
Yeah.
You go straight into the good gear.
Yeah, all automatics.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, but still, we've got great memories of those early days when we all went ag flying and poorly performing aeroplanes and or drove Nuffield tractors sitting out in the open on a frosty morning. Yeah. It's all part of life, isn't it?
Yeah.
Just developing.
Yeah. There's a lot of those things you look back on fondly now, but in the moment, It wasn't a pleasant experience while you're there freezing and shoveling this stuff for hours on end, days after day.
Well, just think, we were flying Cessna 180s cabin with air vents in them, heaters, and the previous generation of ag pilots have been flying Tiger Moths.
Yeah.
Beyond belief, that change.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Especially all the dust they used to have blowing in their faces.
And Dominion newspapers stuffed down the inside of their jackets to keep themselves warm.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's a newspaper. That's a great insulation.
Yeah.
Method.
Yeah, crikey.
I remember talking to some of those early ag pilots who went from Tiger Moths to Beavers. And just, that's an unbelievable step up.
Yeah.
That'll never, ever be repeated, to go from those horrible things. I remember talking to Bruce Thompson when he first got a Beaver and went down to work in Masterton, And he said they'd arrive at the end of the day and been out and done 100-odd ton or something. He'd walk into the Aero Club to have a quiet beer at the end of the day, and the local boys would come in there, get out of a Tiger Moth and just be frozen solid, go in and try to have a drink with these fellows that had been in comfort all day.
Yeah.
The changeover, the change step up was just incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crikey. I imagine they'd need a stiff drink after a chilly day out there.
Yes. Crikey.
Yeah. Did you have any interesting hiccups in the choppers? Any engine failures or, you know, get close to hitting anything, something like that?
No, because you're down low and in gullies, you do come across wires, you know, like electric fence back in those days.
Yeah.
They've done a great job here in New Zealand trying to get rid of wires on farms, and that's really made a big difference.
Yeah.
I remember there one year I hit, I think, 6 electric fence wires in a space of 12 months. No damage at all, just on a boom or nick an undercarriage, you know. Yeah.
Fixed skid. Swing.
No, that was back in the helicopter days, because you're in spraying in gullies, and back then the farmer wanted to go across from one side of the gully to the other, so he just suspended the wire across the gully.
Crikey, so that, where would it catch and what happened?
Well, just caught in different places, but never ever brought us down on the ground, got away with each one.
Holy.
So.
That must have been a interesting experience. Oh, well, it wouldn't be a pleasant experience hitting those.
No, it wasn't. No.
Did you have briefings and were you told about these?
A lot of these wires were put there by the previous owner or worker on the farm, and the owner that we were working for didn't even know the existence of these different wires.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Crikey.
I remember hitting one day on the left-hand boom and it hooked up and the wire stayed there and I just slowed down and then had to back up and manoeuvre the boom around, unhook the wire, carry on working.
Wow. Must have been close to something. If you think back.
No, the only bad one I had was doing loads of fence posts, and the farmer had tied the fence posts up with number 8 wire and had it up about 2 feet above the load, and I came in to pick up one load. The farmer hooked it on, and unfortunately the front of the left-hand skid went under the wire for the next load.
Oh.
And a U300 will carry one load of fence posts, but not 2, especially when the second one's on the toe of the left skid.
Crikey.
So that was roll forward and down the hill. The helicopter flew to bits. My left foot got caught under the left-hand rudder pedal. I remember thinking, this is what it's like, a cowboy falls off and gets his foot caught in the stirrup.
Yeah.
So we rolled down the hill, I don't know how many times.
Like you hit the ground, rolled?
Yeah, rolling down the hill. And the slack was taken up in my left knee, which I suffered from for the next 25 years until I got the knee operated on. I think it was ACC's oldest case in New Zealand to pay for a new knee that had been injured about 25 years previously. But it just got that bad in the end, we had to do it.
Yeah.
So that was the only accident that I had in a helicopter in 8,500 hours. Never had an accident spraying, but that was just doing that lifting job.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I had to put up with the opposition arriving to pick me up and take me into the Palms North Hospital. And that was John Fennell and Ahilla.
But you were, apart from your knee,
the only injury.
Okay.
Was my knee.
Did he give you a bit of stick when he picked you up?
No, just looked at me, and that was it.
Fair enough.
Because we both competed to get the job.
Yeah.
We'll talk the cocky why he should use me and not him.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Were you less than friends at that point?
No, we've always been friends.
Yeah, okay.
Just a bit of ribbing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crikey. Far out. Well, there you go. Where did we get up to? I'm getting sidetracked on all this interesting stuff. I had no idea you did all this chopper stuff.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. So you started out 81 and got your ag cat.
Yes, Griffin Ag, yes.
Yeah. Was there any Was that the first one in country?
Yes, it was. That was quite a procedure back in those days.
Yeah, so why?
Getting it approved, the CAA said that the AGCAT hadn't been spin tested because America, FAA, don't make a spin test agricultural aeroplanes. The spin recovery on ag ops is irrelevant.
It's irrelevant, yeah.
You've come across something hard.
Yeah.
So they said, when I got it here, they said, we've warned you that we won't certify it. And I said, well, it's certified in 63 other countries. I said, either they are wrong or you are wrong.
You choose.
Yeah. So after a prolonged discussion backwards and forwards, after in getting Bernie Lewis to spin test or give it a trial flight in Auckland, he was a highly respected test pilot from the RAF, and he'd done ag flying in helicopters, but he was, you know, qualified fixed wing as well. And he told me a full spin recovery program would involve 14 hours of flying because there's something like 50 different ways of entering a spin. But they abbreviated the spin testing program and he went up and did probably a couple of hours and that was it.
Yeah.
And they approved, signed it out.
Right. What do they even look for in a spin thing? To make sure it stops spinning?
Yeah, stop spinning and all the different ways you can enter it and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, fair enough. Why did you choose it just to begin with, of all the options that were out there?
Well, it was a larger capacity ag aeroplane over and above a Pawnee or an ag wagon.
Yeah, which and, was?
Yeah, the Pawnee was 500 litres, ag wagon was 700, and the AGCAT was 1,000.
Okay.
So we're stepping up in capacity. Plus, I was always impressed with the safety of an AGCAT. They looked after it with something like AGCATs did. A million hours flying before they had a fatality, which is incredible safety record when you think of it.
Yeah.
Since then, they've had odd fatal because they, with turbine aeroplanes, you're flying faster, and that probably reduces the chance of a pilot surviving.
Mm.
Back in those early AGCAT days, there were 300 horsepower Jacobs engines, so they weren't flying at many knots, so they had a tangle, they were going pretty slow. But
yeah.
As a modern ag aeroplane, you go up in performance and capacity.
Yeah.
But you've got a far greater speed when you touch the ground. If you had a wire strike or, like in the States, they have the odd mid-air collisions.
Mm. Yeah, I've seen a few of those photos there.
Yeah, it ends up bad.
Yeah. Which is, weren't most of those that didn't have radios in there or something like that? So
yeah, it can happen even... Around here, you get close to ag aeroplanes. We've had near misses in New Zealand.
Yeah.
With, you know, people working on the same job or next door.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So was your radial 300 horsepower?
No, my first one was 450.
450.
Yeah, 985, same engine that's in the Beaver.
Oh, yeah.
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 Okay. Nice, beautiful engine, that 450 horsepower. That's the smoothest radial you'll ever fly.
Yeah.
Got to remember the 1340 that's in the Harvard or in the bigger AGCATs. That was started up Christmas Eve 1926. And the 985 wasn't built until 1935.
Yeah.
So you had nearly 10 years of improving the balance in the engine and the design of it.
Yeah.
So because of that, the 985 is very smooth.
Right.
Whereas the 1340 is a little bit harsher.
Yeah.
It's quite a harsh engine. Yeah, but you've got extra power.
Yeah, how do you mean harsh?
Just a little bit harsh running, just whereas the 985 is very soft.
And no, like temperatures and...
No, just the feeling of turning over, the way it's operating, running all day.
Oh, yeah.
Like you'll get some piston engines that are smooth and some that are not so smooth.
Yeah.
You know, like you flying a Beaver, the engine's only 18 inches away from you, but yeah. It's very smooth, the 985.
Right.
There's a 1340s, a little bit rough, not quite so smooth.
Yeah. So why didn't you just get a Beaver, which was the same horsepower, same capacity?
For spraying?
Yeah, when you got, as opposed to getting your AGCAT.
Oh, a little bit controversial here. The Beaver's probably the world's, prior to turbines, the world's best top dressing aeroplane. But to be honest, it's probably the world's worst spraying aeroplane.
Right.
Believe it or not. B bit of a contradiction there.
Yeah.
But no, it's wonderful on top dressing, but on spraying it's not. Because the elevator control, when you're near the ground and you want to change the attitude of the aeroplane, you've got to have about 10 degrees of flap down. Otherwise, the elevator's not very sensitive. So you come across the fence line halfway along the spray run, pull the elevator back, and very little movement happens. It's very slow to react. Whereas you have the flap down, it's a little bit better.
Does that change the airflow over? Yeah,
it changes the airflow.
Yeah, right.
And the visibility is not very good out of the cockpit of a Beaver. You can't only see straight ahead. You can't see to the sides.
Mm.
So it's not a good spray aeroplane.
Yeah. How did you learn about the needing 10 degrees of flap to get better elevator authority?
Probably going back to the 180 days. The Barry Sait, he was the guru of spraying in 180s with rural, and he always taught all those rural pilots to put one notch of flap down in a 180. Same problem.
On spray run.
On spray runs. So you see photographs of Barry spraying from the old days, and you can always see he's got one notch of flap down to give better elevator control.
Yeah.
Huh. So that's how you learned that. Plus, you know, standing at a bar, having the odd drink with a experienced pilot, and they soon tell you what you should do, what you shouldn't do.
Was the bar chatter pretty open and helpful with all of that?
Very beneficial, what you learned standing alongside other pilots.
Yeah.
I remember a pilot, John Harvey, who just started with Manawatu Aerial before me, and he'd been loader driving in Australia. And while he was loader driving, a opposition pilot flew at a hill range at 90 degrees and got a slight downdraft coming over the ridge, and he couldn't clear the ridge. So after that, all the Aussie Ag pilots always told everybody to approach the ridge at 45, 50 degrees. So if you've got a turn off, it's only a little turn to avoid it, not a 90-degree turn.
Yeah.
And I remember the night John Harvey told me that little story. So 60 years later.
Yeah.
Still there.
Yeah, it must have worked its way through into the books now, because I was always taught that.
Yes.
And same, I used to use it a lot overseas when I was flying in the hills there.
And I was talking to an experienced Aussie ag pilot a while ago, Cole Adams, who's been ag flying about the same time as I have. And I related that story. He said, if you're ever over here in Cootamundra, he said, I'll take you up and show you where that aeroplane came to grief. He was the opposition pilot. So that reinforced it.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. And was the Beaver not so good on spraying had nothing to do with the spray pattern or anything?
No, nothing.
It was just the flying.
No.
Flying side of it.
High winged aeroplanes always look nice spraying, because the spray boom is so visible. It's down below the wing. You can see it. You see 180s, photographs of 180 spraying or Beavers. Mm. They look nice. Whereas a low winged aeroplane, the spray boom is hidden in behind the wing, and it's not such a standout feature.
Yeah. And are they, all of the high wing, they were almost like struts, the booms. Is that? Yes. I don't think I've seen many where the booms are straight out on a high wing.
Close to straight out, but they come up, but not much.
Right.
The only high wing that I've seen with a really different spray system was when I was flying in Western Australia back in the 60s with Doggett Aviation. They were operating EP9s, which are high-winged aeroplanes, and the owner there said the spray boom's got to be behind the wing. So he had a little stub boom under the fuselage and then had the spray booms up on top behind the wing.
Right.
And so it was a long way off the ground when you're spraying in a high-winged aeroplane and the boom's up by the high wing. It's really too far off the ground.
Yeah.
I don't think it was a good idea. And that's the only aeroplane I've ever seen.
Yeah.
With a separate mounted boom up on top.
Yeah, okay. When did you say you were over there?
1967 or 1965. I started flying in 64. 1965, I went to Albury and flew a Pawnee and a Cropmaster.
How'd you wing that job?
Oh, mad keen to go and have a look at something else in another part of the world.
Yeah.
So I went over there. I was only 20 years old.
You went over there as in just packed your bags up and
went.
Didn't know anyone, just tried your hand.
Would have liked to have got a job flying a Beaver for aerial agriculture. They were the Beaver kings in the world. They operated up to 44 Beavers with their three companies. in New South Wales, Victoria and South Australia.
Yeah.
But they didn't have a job for a 20-year-old. So I rang up Keith Deeth, who operated Hayes Air in Albury. There was an offshoot of the Hayes Air, Jim Hazelden business in Orange. Went there and he gave me a job.
Right. Relation to Stephen?
Steve's father.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah. So the year that I arrived in Albury, Steve arrived as a person in the world. So I've known him ever since.
Yeah. All of his life.
Yes.
Crikey. Yeah.
And so I flew the Pawnee and then flew the Cropmaster, which was extremely enjoyable. Cropmaster was like flying a little fighter.
That's a tail dragger and you're in front of the hopper.
That's right.
Yeah.
Tail dragger, yeah.
Yeah, those aircraft, they look really nice, just as a from an aesthetic standpoint, yeah. I reckon.
I could tell you a lot of stories about Cropmasters, how unique they were.
Yeah.
Their little spade grip, like a Spitfire.
Oh, okay.
Because they were developed from the Wackett trainer, which was a wooden winged aeroplane.
Right.
And they gradually converted them. They converted Wackets as ag aeroplanes, built one with a hopper in front of the pilot in the front cockpit. And the guy that bought it said, it's a good aeroplane, but I don't like where the hopper is. I don't want the hopper in front of me because I get splashed when it gets too full. So I put it around the other way. So that was a KS-3. Then they built the Cropmaster and gradually changed it over to a metal aeroplane from the wood.
Yeah.
And put the swept-back fin and rudder on it and the fully flying tailplane.
Oh,
and the Joker Smith, who was the owner of the business, he was a brother of Tech Smith. He went out and saw Comanche parked on the tarmac and measured up the Comanche tailplane, came back and built one and put it on the Cropmaster.
Hmm.
So the Cropmaster tailplane is a copy of the Comanche. And then put the swept-back fin and rudder on it, which looked very attractive.
Yeah, they do look nice. There's a fella, and when I was in Gore the other day, he's rebuilding one. I'm not sure if you've seen it.
Yes, no, I've seen that. Very good.
Yeah, looks amazing. And there was one in Waipuk
not too long ago. That's gone to Australia.
Has it? Okay. Mm. Yeah, they're very nice. Where were they?
They were built in Bankstown Airport.
Oh, okay.
Yes. They built it. I don't know how many they built, but they were better than 180. 180 was a 1,000-weight aeroplane. The Cropmaster was about 1,200 weight. So at the end of the day, they could do a little bit more work.
Yeah. And what was
the... They were nice to fly, beautifully light on the controls.
Yeah. What was the engine in those?
Varying engines, I think mainly the 260 horsepower. And they had, some of them had Lycoming, some had Continentals.
Yeah.
And they drew out plans. There is plans you can see. They never built one. But they designed one called the Fieldmaster, I think it was going to be. And it was a two-seat side-by-side cockpit instead of a single seat and a tricycle undercarriage. So it looked like a copy of a Fletcher.
Yeah, it would too.
And they were going to put 300 horsepower on the front of that.
Yeah.
But they never developed it.
Yeah.
By that time, the ag wagons had arrived cheap in Australia and air trucks and, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, lovely, great memories having flown one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I flew one spraying as well. It was a nice sprayer because it was so crisp and fast on the ailerons.
Yeah. So was the majority of, or the start of the flying you did in Aussie top dressing, solids?
Yeah, top dressing for a start and then spraying about 50-50.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Was it all cropping land?
Or? Yes, cropping land around Albury, but that's fairly productive pasture area. So the crop paddocks weren't very big like out west. Yeah.
Yeah.
And up the river there above the Ume Weir, up towards Corryong, that was top dressing, hill country.
Yeah.
Top dressing. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And did you say you flew the Pawnee there as well?
Flew the Pawnee there.
Which version of Pawnee was that?
235.
235.
Singles, yeah.
Yeah. They go all right?
Yes. No, nice. Actually, TOI was a registration. TOJ, I think it was, yes. Then a couple of years later, I went to Western Australia flying for Doggett Aviation and ended up flying the same aeroplane.
Huh.
In Western, over there in the West.
Yeah.
Mm.
I like the Pawnee only because they're only single-seaters, or the ones I've flown, so you jump in. It's probably, was that standard for when you're getting a type rating, you just learn yourself. But I mean, nowadays it's not. You have to have dual instruction on everything. Right. But
yeah. Later on, talking about the West, I went back to Doggers another year, and they got me to go to Albury with Keith Deeth and pick up a two-seat Pawnee. The Aussies did a mod where they widened the cockpit, and you had two seats side by side. They probably converted 15, 20 of them.
Yeah.
And I flew that right across Australia.
Yeah, right.
And then when I got to Western Australia, I top dressed or sprayed in it.
Did they widen the...
Yeah, widened it. Yeah, it was, you know, about almost the width of a Cessna 180.
Okay.
Just brought the longerons past the hopper. Instead of narrowing it in there to the tail, they kept going to the cockpit, rear cockpit. So they were about 4 inches wider.
Interesting.
Yeah, same as virtually the same as a fat man. That's the same width. That takes two people in the cockpit.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you ended up like that.
Yeah. Gee, I don't know if the fatty wasn't too comfortable. I've only really sat in the dicky seat in that. It's a bit of a squeeze.
Yeah, no, so it was a long way from Albury to Perth. It was a couple of days, and I took another pilot over with me. So it was fairly friendly.
Yeah. And what were you cruising at in those, 110?
Can't remember.
Yeah. Well, they're not fast anyway.
No, they're not. But an amazing, good little aeroplane.
Yeah.
Probably a good, honest aeroplane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you use flap in the turn in any of the aircraft?
No.
No.
Only use flap in a air tractor.
Yeah.
Or a Beaver. Beaver lives on flap.
Right.
It's another control surface virtually.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I'm saying the major difference with those Pawnees in Australia, they all retain the fuselage fuel tank, which is, of course, right in the middle of the aeroplane. Whereas in New Zealand, because of our record, we had fires and Pawnees and put the wingtip tanks out there that sort of negatively affected the controls and the flying of the aeroplane, because you had to get those fuel tanks moving. And then at the end of the turn, wing down, you wanted to lift the wing up, you had to get it stopped. So there were a bit of a delay in the controls.
Yeah.
And also shifted the CFG slightly rearward. So the Aussie fuel tank machines were vastly superior to the New Zealand wing Pawnees.
They're another one that looks cool. They were sort of on the way out when I started flying. But they use them a lot for glider towing now.
They do, very popular for glider towing.
Yeah, those and the fatty.
And the other aeroplanes, popular XAG machine that we never ever saw in New Zealand, was the A9 Corlair, which had the 235 horsepower engine, same as a Pawnee.
Yeah.
There's a lot of those used in Australia.
Yeah.
Glider towing.
So that's what we were talking about earlier, wasn't it? Because I thought we had those here.
No, there was a B1, the big one.
Yeah.
Yeah, which wasn't.
But they looked the same. They were just...
Same shape, but twice as big.
Yeah.
Sort of thing.
Yeah. And you had a burn in those for a bit.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And they were...
wasn't too impressed with it.
Right.
I remember going up one day, I was spraying at Taiapi for Rex Garnham. He didn't have any spray aeroplanes, rang a Cheeky Air Services at Taiapi, and he took me in his office and he said, look at this. He said, I bought a couple of these. He said, I can buy two of them and a spare engine for the price of one Beaver, and it carries a ton, just the same as a Pawnee carries half a ton. I thought, yeah, it sounds good.
What's the catch?
It wasn't good in the end. Yeah.
Albury to WA, and then is that how you ended up working in WA, just from that shift in that aircraft?
The first year I went to Australia. No, sorry. The last year, the first year, I flew. That's right, I got a ride over in a Cessna 182. I knew Phil Balfour, who was working for Simpson Aviation as a sales rep in Perth, had been Rex Aviation's or Rural's agent in New Plymouth. So I knew him. So he got me a ride over in a 182. And then the second year was the year that I took the two-seat Pawnee over.
Right.
And then when I was in Western Australia, we swapped our series aeroplane for a Pawnee in South Australia. So all those trips individually are about 2 days to fly across Australia.
Gee. They were big days as well.
Yeah, they were big days, but it's good fun.
Yeah.
Flying across Australian Bight, not a ball plane. Yeah.
Crikey. Was it hot? Well, of course it's hot. It's Australia, but was it hot in the...
No, it was winter time that I was doing it in May and June. By that time, Australia and the southern realms is, you know, cool as New Zealand.
Yeah. So those EP9s, they never seen one up close. So you're on top.
Yes, sitting up top.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll show you. I got one in the hangar out there.
Oh, yeah.
I was always fascinated when I was a young fellow going to the fielding sale on a Friday and drive past fielding airfield, a minute or two aerial top dressing were there, and they had the only EP9 ever imported in New Zealand. And I saw it at the 1956 air show in Palmerston. I was, what, do the sums, 12 years old. Got mum and dad to take myself and my brother in there. And that was the first international air aviation air show on a massive scale.
Right.
And I remember seeing Douglas Bader being put into a Cessna 180 with Miles King, because Douglas Bader had tin legs.
Yeah.
So a couple of guys had to lift him up and put him in the front seat. And Miles King flew him out to the Keble airstrip where they had a few displays by the Manawatu Gorge, and he sewed a few loads, and he was highly impressive.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I think cool. He sort of reckoned it compared to Battle of Britain type of flying.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so having seen him was a memory I'll never forget.
Yeah. There's some video footage of that that's floating around still from the...
Yes. I remember driving in there. I could show you the gateway we drove through. It's just being developed at Palmer South Airport for a housing area. And as we drove across there, I looked up and saw an auricular doing a turn. And I can see it like it's yesterday.
Yeah.
And I've got one of those in the hangar as well.
Cool.
So I've got a few connections. And then in the back of the hangar here, I've also got the Transland Ag 2 that was booked in here to come to that air show in 1956.
Transland?
Ag 2. AG 2. If you go back in history of aircraft design, ag aircraft design in the States, they built an airplane called the Ag 1, which was a Texas A&M college built it as an experimental, prove the concept of an ag airplane with a pilot sitting in the back and the load in the front. And they wrote that off, and an accident hit a power line while it was doing a display. The pilot stepped out of it. So they all said, that's how you got to build an airplane. So then I think Transland Company bought the design of it for $1 and built the Ag 2. And this one I've got, here's a prototype. They only ever built three of them. It was supposed to come in 56, but it wasn't certified. So they flew that. It wasn't very successful. It had a few major design problems, one being that the hopper wasn't removable. It was part of the structure of the aeroplane. Just doubled up skin.
Right.
And had a massively fat wing on it that makes a wing on a Fletcher look like it's come off a fighter. Right. Fletcher wing, 16% ratio of the leading edge of the wing to the trailing edge by the depth is 16%. The Ag 2 is 22%. So it's just a massively thick wing with colossal drag.
Yeah.
So we heard about it and being in South America years ago, abandoned, managed to do a deal. And we got it back here.
Right. So it never actually worked here?
No, it could never fly. It got lots of corrosion.
Yeah.
And being parked outside, so.
Yeah.
It'll probably end up back in the States one day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Oh, plenty of history.
But it's good to have it here. And then the Ag 3, of course, was the first Pawnee. Fred Wyke, who designed the first AG-1, he didn't have anything to do with the AG-2. Then Piper took him on to make the Piper Cub. They were having a lot of Piper Cub accidents with the pilot sitting in the front. So Piper said, turn the Piper Cub into a safe ag aeroplane. So he built the AG-3, which then became the Pawnee.
Oh.
The first one he built it with a cockpit up on top of the present windscreen. So it was to get the pilot away from being in between the engine and the hopper.
Yeah.
They flew it. I have got the odd photograph I've seen of it. Then he built the AG-3, which only had 135 horsepower. Later put the 150 in it, which was it was safer if he had an accident, but didn't perform as good as a Cub.
Mm.
It's just me being a Cessna man proves my theory of you can't beat a high-winged aeroplane.
Mm.
in comparison to a low-winged aeroplane.
Yeah.
A little bit like comparing the performance or the ceiling of a Cessna 185 and a 300 horsepower egg wagon. It's a colossal difference between the two.
Yeah.
But, of course, we would prefer the low-winged cockpit in the rear egg aeroplane concept. It's a lot more preferable, and that's the way the whole world's gone with Air Tractor and Thrush.
Yeah.
Air Cat, all of them.
Yeah, and can they ever change it? The economy's trying to say, make it. I mean, you try and design a new plane, just in general, let alone an ag one, the cost of that's.
Yeah, I have seen one aeroplane I was lucky to see. I went to the States 30 years ago probably, and I went through California and saw different various ag operators. It's another story in itself. That many of them, aeroplanes that even I got sick of watching them at the end of the day. I couldn't take any more. Yeah. And I came across the Predator, which was a routine designed ag aeroplane. And that was very, very revolutionary. It had a canard wing with a wing in the front and composite aeroplane, total, the whole thing. Hmm. And super duper safe.
Yeah.
Very, very low drag. They compared it to the drag of an ag cat, in which Joker said proves that anything can fly if you put a big enough engine on the front.
Mm.
In comparison to this composite ag aeroplane. But it had problems in itself.
Yeah.
And it never ever got put into production.
Right. Like when was this that you saw it?
About 85.
Okay.
85, 86.
Gee.
Yeah.
That would have been pretty revolutionary or technologically advanced for its day.
Yeah, I think it's that problem that you, instead of your elevators and tailplane at the back, the elevator is in the front. And if you stall that, then the nose just drops back on the ground, which is what happened to it. They had it at an air show and the guy dragged it off a bit slow and then the nose stalled and dropped down and he went through the fence and destroyed the aeroplane. He got out all right because he was sitting right in the back.
Yeah.
You know, it's a good look that aeroplane up on the old, you know, screen here and have a look at it. He designed another one as well called the X-Wing, I think. And he actually had the pilot sitting in the leading edge in a cockpit in the fin. So he was right in the back there. And then had a wing going from the top of the fin to the wingtips. And then a canard wing. That was his idea of an egg aeroplane.
Wow.
So you could see something like that one day, that type of, but a major concept turnaround.
Yeah.
And of course, is the demand there for ag aeroplanes? You know, like the Yanks are probably building between Air Tractor and Thrush, probably not even 100 a year.
Mm.
So it's a fairly limited market.
Yeah.
Except for the firefighting, that's a big new concept. But whether that goes to bigger aeroplanes again, I don't know.
Well, it already is. They've got the 1002 or what, I don't know what they're going to call it. But the next one up from the 802, that's nearly finished.
Yes, but even bigger than that, that's what I think about your Canadairs.
Oh, yeah.
And using your DC-10s, 747s.
Yeah.
How bigger that gets, it depends what this climate change
ends
up doing to the world or whether we start going back the other way. But
yeah,
it's going to be quite a few years, I think, before the world's temperatures turn around the other way.
Yeah. I wonder if they'll do the same with ag aircraft, the likes of when they had the DC-3s and Loadstars, whether they're going to do the same on farms high capacity.
For spraying work, I can't see it. I think the 1002, when that gets into production, that's about the end of the line.
Yeah.
I never forgetting being at an American convention years ago, and Leland Snow was the guest speaker, and he just brought out the 502, and everybody was marvelling how big it was and saying they'd never buy one, only some operators. And somebody said, will you go bigger? And he said, yeah. He said, I'll go to a 1002. And there was a hush went through the room. People couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
But he's not far off the truth.
Yeah.
I remember when the first 802 arrived in Australia and everybody marvelled and said, that's the only one you'll ever see in Australia.
Yeah.
And look, there's more 802s now in Australia than 502s.
That's right. Yeah, there's a lot of operators that only have 802s.
Yes.
Yeah. And the chap who I was telling you I'm with, he's got a couple of 710s, the Thrush version of it. So, it's. Did the EP9 fly differently or feel differently because you're sitting on top? You know, is You're a little bit higher up.
No, once you're in it, it's the same. Great visibility out the front when the tail comes up.
Yeah.
Flies very similar to a beaver. When you think, look at it, it's pretty similar copy of a beaver. It's got drooping flaps and ailerons right out to the wingtip. Very similar characteristics.
Yeah, okay.
Quite an amazing performer for, you know, the horsepower that was in the front of it.
Yeah. How many horsepower was?
The Manawa 2's one, and the early ones were 270.
Oh.
Then they upped the old compression, and they took the last ones, and my one is 290 horsepower. Yeah, but they could on odd occasions, don't tell anybody, they could carry up to a ton, which is quite amazing for 270 horsepower.
Wow.
But normally they were a 1,500 weight aeroplane.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But they were multi-purpose. They could spray and cargo and freight. Like Manawa 2 bought their one for doing freight up into the hills with Forest Service.
Yeah.
Servicing huts and dropping huts in. And
as in take the hopper out.
Take the hopper out, take the rear door off and slide your freight on rollers right up to the back of the firewall underneath the cockpit.
Yeah.
And then release it when you're over the drop zone, fire them out the back on bungees and parachute.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And did you do some of that?
I never did it. It was before my time.
Yeah.
And then those confounded helicopters arrived.
Yeah.
And took that market over totally.
Yeah.
So there wasn't any need for a fixed wing flying in hill country.
Yeah.
Yeah, or in ranges.
Good little machines, eh?
The Australians only built 27 EP9s. And the Australians bought about 8 of them, and they quite liked them. Yeah, they were quite a good aeroplane in Australia, except overheating. So then the Australians did a mod that made probably one of the world's ugliest aeroplanes into definitely the ugliest aeroplanes. And they put an Armstrong Sinley Cheetah 10 engine radial in the front. So they did about 3 or 4 of those.
Yeah.
And they looked shocking.
Right.
So they upped their horsepower to about 400. So they weren't quite good, but they were horrible looking machines.
Yeah. Did you ever go on those?
No, never.
No.
I never. I went for a ride in an EP9 spraying in Western Australia, but I never got a rating on one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. The what's the PL11 sounds like that would have looked pretty similar to this radial one you're talking about.
Yeah, the PL7 was the very first one.
Yeah.
That's the one, the first PL7 tanker that they built in Australia.
Oh.
Pellerini.
A staggered
yeah,
staggered wing
and then had two booms out the front like a, you know, latest air trucks.
Yeah.
But then they connected it across the back so you couldn't drive the loader in to put a load of furt in it. They only built one of them, yes.
Yeah. I think there's only one or two photos of it as well.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Years ago, I was flying a Fletcher in Armidale, and there was a beaver pilot flying for aerial agriculture, and he'd done quite a bit of the test flying as an engineer in that machine, that PL7. And that was Pellerini's first effort.
Yeah, right.
And then he came to New Zealand and went to Tikawiti with the PL11, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, the New Zealand radial air truck.
Mm.
And then, of course, the PL12 Transavia air truck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But and that's what Hazier ended up with, a couple of those. Is that right?
Yes, I still got two of them working occasionally, backups mainly. And then there's a farmer enthusiast up in the hills above Albury who's got one of them going and just about to fly a second one.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, Don Hart's got his one getting close to flying again.
Yeah. Saw photos of that the other day. That's looking really good.
Quite an amazing aeroplane, that, for 300 horsepower to performance.
Yeah, because I got yarn into the recently, in the last 5 or 10 years, some chap made a documentary on it.
Yes.
He just did it himself.
Yes.
And I was talking to him the other day about it, and he was explaining the Pellegrini guy was yarning to the pilots, you know, and the engineers, what's the hardest part of all the ag planes, or what's the biggest cost? And they said all the furt corroding the back end of the plane. So he designed it with the twin booms, so none of the furt would hit the back of the plane, because it didn't have a back of a plane.
No, the idea was good.
Mm. Yeah, it sounded like he was quite practical and solving the issues of the day.
Now, again, that's like the old beaver. You don't get many pilots who flew air trucks who don't swear by them. Performance-wise, they're extremely good.
Yeah.
Those Wairarapa fellows, all of those guys who flew them, loved them.
What was their downfall in the end? Was it the load?
No, two bigger turbine aeroplanes. No. You couldn't put a bigger hopper in it because the hopper was part of your structure.
They had a few of those in China when I was there as well, parked up.
That's right.
Air trucks there.
And those had the 720, 400 horsepower Lycoming put in them.
Right.
Those Chinese ones.
Yeah. How do you know about them?
Don't know anything in life other than ag aeroplanes.
Yeah. Yeah, clearly.
And my family. Just remember that.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I know we're getting sidetracked, but I just find all that stuff interesting. So you were in WA for a few years.
Three winters.
Three winters. Yeah. As in you would go there for the winter and come back.
Yep, yeah, that's right.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Arrive over there about June.
Yeah.
And then work there for 4 months and then come back here.
Yeah.
And, of course, in those days there was virtually no work in the winter in New Zealand.
Yeah. So it worked out well with...
Worked out very well.
With your companies here.
Yes.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's before I went out on my own. When I went out on my own, of course, couldn't get away.
Yeah.
The only regret I had in my ag flying career is that I went to Western Australia. I didn't regret that, but I enjoyed that. But didn't do what a lot of the other Kiwis did, and that was go to England. And they, all those guys have got great memories of ag flying in England.
Yeah.
Then quite a few of them did that. Then went to the Sudan. And initially flew Pawnees down there and later on Pilatus Porters.
Yeah, okay.
And a lot of those guys ferried aeroplanes, ferried Pawnees from England through Europe.
Yeah.
Across the Mediterranean down into Africa.
Yeah.
Which, great memories.
Yeah. Were they spraying with the Porters?
Yes, spraying with the Porters.
Ah.
Yes, Seba Pilatus.
Yeah.
Yeah, Noel Kinvig was the chief pilot and he was living in Hungary for a few years and he's now back in New Zealand.
Yeah, okay.
He's an ex-field air contracts pilot from the East Coast.
Yeah.
And a shearer before that.
Huh.
And he ended up as chief pilot of the Porters. And they sprayed with them as well in Pakistan. There's a whole story on those machines.
Right.
Johnny Ricker, who I said was on the commercial pilot school with me, he was one of those Porter pilots in the Pakistan.
Gee.
Bangladesh, I think they used them.
Yeah. Mm. So these chaps are still around?
Yes, well, Noel Kinvig is still around.
Yeah.
Yeah. Johnny Ricker's still around. I don't know about the other ones. Yeah. Oh, yeah, Jack Snow, he's still around.
Oh, yeah.
Down around Wellington, he was ex-CAA.
Yeah.
He flew Porters.
We'll have to...
He was the second Kiwi pilot to go flying the Sudan. The first one was a fellow called Evan Gray. And I remember him seeing my EP9 because he used to fly one in the Sudan. I don't know if he flew that particular machine.
Yeah.
But he did, yeah.
Yeah. How did all of that work come about? I know you didn't do it, but you would have been talking to all the fellas there, the stuff in England and Sudan.
I think the Sudan, there was a very English influence still in the politics of the Sudan. So, of course, they used English companies. There was quite big operators in England. ADS Aerial, which was a Hungarian guy, Marmo, owned that business.
Yeah.
And then... crop culture, they were down through there. They were in Jamaica as well, all over those parts of the world.
Yeah.
So they had fleets of aeroplanes. So they could, of course, go there in the cotton season and spray in the Sudan because they had massive areas of cotton growing there.
Mm. Yeah.
But then later on, change of government, change of influence, the English were driven out of the Sudan and the Russians moved in there with AN2s, I gather.
Yeah. Well, they had a bunch of ag cats in Ethiopia when 2006 or 2007,
right.
I was there, and they just bought a handful of them. They're all new. They might have been a couple of years old, but they only do a season a year, so they're pretty low out. Then I was going through and having a good look at all of those. It's quite neat.
Royce Hookahooka, who we were talking about before, he went over there and flew one of those.
Oh yeah,
radials. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
And then later on they did a deal with Schweitzer, who had the contract for building air cats, and Ethiopian Airlines built 6 turbine air cats on contract.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's happened to them, I don't know.
Yeah, they were all turbines.
Yeah.
When I, well, the majority of them were turbines. Can't remember them all, but
Now if you talk about the Sedan, you see that program, I think, what was it called, Out of Africa?
Yeah.
Had Kiwis spraying. Max Lacey was one of them.
Yeah. Well,
a whole bunch of them. Yeah.
Speaking of, I think I met Max Lacey when I was in Tanzania.
Yeah.
2006, 2007. I was in this doing that survey stuff.
Yeah.
That Kiwi Air thing. We're in the middle of nowhere. It's town Tabora. And just sitting at our hotel, and this Kiwi chap heard him talking behind me, and we got talking, and if it was him, I can't really recall the name, which is a shame, but I'm pretty sure Max Lacey was his name. But in any case, he was flying a 185, and he had about a 200-litre
belly tank,
yep.
Yeah.
And he said he just goes around looking for locusts and spraying locusts, and that was his job, and he had some interesting stories to tell about his whole flying 748s up and down Africa and doing low-key gun runs for people and that. But, yeah, just out of the blue, saw him there. We got talking at the bar, having dinner, and then the next day he was gone.
Yeah.
But it's kind of funny, the people you see in the most randomest of places, and they've all got ties to someone, you know. It's not 6 degrees of separation.
No, it doesn't happen so much now, but back in the late 60s, 70s, 80s, there was a bunch of Kiwis that just flew all over the world, ag flying, doing seasons here, seasons there, all up through Africa. Quite amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you don't get that now. There's a few still doing it, but very few.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course, they made a lot of money doing that sort of thing, going from season to season.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know one pilot went right through Africa, you know, South Africa, Mozambique, Angola, Sudan, Egypt, Morocco, all around the whole place.
Yeah.
Season to season. Crikey. Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, so that's the only thing I missed, not doing that sort of thing, but then I went and got married, so...
Yeah.
69, and that was last year. Took my wife, new wife, over to Western Australia and flew to John Forrest up in Carnarvon. That was a fixed base operation. The Doggett operation was living in the caravan.
Yeah.
With your loader driver, tee-up man, and two marker boys that stood on the end of the fields.
Mm.
And that was a bit rough existence.
Yeah.
Not many facilities to shower or wash or anything.
Yeah.
Just borrow the odd shearer's quarters off a local cocky.
Yeah.
Whereas a fixed base operation was a good one with John Forrest.
Was he in New Zealand flying you out to Perth? Would they go there from Auckland?
No, I can't remember. I remember in the early days flying to Wellington to Sydney in the Electris.
Oh, yeah?
Flying across Australia with, I don't know, TAA.
Yeah.
Well, my father-in-law worked for TAA on the ground. So I used to fly TAA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did they give you earplugs before you jumped in?
Yeah, no. You just accepted what's the standard in those days, eh?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's right. It's the same with flying. There's a lot of photos with... Well, did you have a helmet and a earpiece and stuff when you started?
Air flying?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I always had a helmet.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we didn't have radios in the early days.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, of course. Mm. Which is... amazes me that without radios and a lot of aircraft darting around low level, ag aircraft all around the same area.
Yes.
But everyone seemed to keep out of each other's way for the most part. It amazes me that things didn't get closer than what they actually were.
No, well, when I was with Manawatu 2 back in the early days, we used double up aeroplanes most days. We didn't help somebody else, but you just accepted it.
Yeah.
Nobody ever talked about it. You just knew where the other guy was.
Yeah.
Whereas now, these days, juggers are very reluctant to work two aeroplanes just because you're not used to it.
Yeah. And that's even with radios.
Yes, with all the gear.
Yeah.
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 No, you don't often see it, but well, especially these days, you wouldn't keep the food up anyway. You're both carrying 2 ton. So every 3 or 4 minutes, you've got 4 ton of food going out. So you get through it pretty quick.
Yeah, that's right. We've found I used to do a bit of doubling up in the King Country, and you needed, as well as having the vert there, you needed the right loaded driver.
Yeah.
They got to be pretty on to it, because I think we worked out if it was anything less than a 3-minute turnaround, we were starting this. We were waiting for the fella, which is only a minute and a half, which when you think about it, that's not a lot of time for a fella to back out and pick up another load and get ready to go.
Best load of driving I think I ever saw was the late Dave Wareham, who was a successful pilot and operator back in his young days when he was a loader driver. We had three egg wagons on a job at Paiatua, and we were doing 4-minute turnaround, three of us, so it was a minute 20 minutes, a minute 20 seconds per trip, and he managed to do it all.
Gee.
It was very, very impressive. He said the loads weren't too accurate, didn't have much time to do it, but he did it.
Yeah.
Talking, you were just raising the point of helmets here. I remember an ag pilot, I won't name him, but he came from Sydney to Perth flying with an airliner to go over the ag flying, and he was sitting in his seat with his helmet on. And, of course, the air hostess walks past and fascinated and had to ask him, what the hell you got a helmet on for? And he said, if you knew the guy flying this aeroplane, you'd have a helmet on as well. And they'd learned to fly together.
Right.
So next minute he gets an invite to go up into the cockpit and stayed there for the rest of the flight.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That pilot's still living in Hamilton, I think. I heard the other day.
There's a lot of them still hanging around that, well, I guess you'd know all about it. It's all from all people you grew up with, but the likes of myself, I don't know half these people, half the names.
Yeah, well, see, when I started in this business, the business had only been going for 13 years when I first went to Manawatu's Hangar.
Yeah.
So, of course, I knew all those early pilots, Manawatu pilots, virtually everybody right from the very beginning.
Yeah.
I'd met John Brazy on many occasions.
Yeah.
Met Roy Griffin, who was a foundation pilot for Manawatu Aerial. He was a namesake of mine, but no relation.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so I talked to him as well. He flew the EP9 when it first came to New Zealand.
Yeah.
Because Manawatu, they bought two of the first five 180s that came to New Zealand, BDC and BDB. And Rural got two BDD and BDE. And Rex Garnham got AZZ. Knew somebody in the registration department who kept him AZZ, so he had a 180 with AZZ written on it. But it was out of sequence. Yeah. Shouldn't have been. Yeah.
Oh, that's good. How are you?
Yeah, no, timing? I'm just about, if you want to, that's enough.
Oh, well, I'm happy to keep going, but I don't want to stop you from your lunch.
But I could keep talking rubbish for.
Yeah, well, this is the same thing I found with Neville yesterday. We barely scratched the surface with him. We only got started and then had to shoot away. So the upshot of it was I'm going to have to come back and catch up with him probably a few times. So we might have to do the same with you, Hallett.
Yes, now you want to come back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're happy to. I'm sure you've got a... Well, we're only up to 1981.
Yeah.
We've got a few decades to go.
Neville's wife, what's her name?
Leonie.
Yeah, Leonie.
Yeah, yeah. They're both lovely people. Yeah, I went and first went into their son Les's hangar who did all the drawings for that book and saw their tiger moth.
Mm.
That they're restoring. And
didn't Neville or another ag pilot, one of their girlfriends, wrote a message on the back lawn about them wanting to marry or do something, or some story from Stratford.
Is that right?
Yeah, one of those. Either who's the other guy I was telling about? She was on TV the other day on holiday with Neil Moore.
Paula.
No, she was. Father flew for air contracts for years. You don't, yeah, one of them, I think,
yeah, okay.
There's some story, I've got to ring old Neville, I'll ask him what the story was,
yeah,
now amazing how he's ended back in the hometown,
yeah,
been all over the North Island, back to Stratford,
yeah, lovely chap, yeah, And that Tiger Moth that Les is doing, that looks immaculate. I think they had one wing when I was there, they had put the fabric on it and they were just stitching it up.
Yeah.
But they're beautiful machines. It's almost we were commenting yesterday, it's almost a shame that they're covering it up because it all just looks so nice in the inside of it, the ribs and...
Yeah.
But no, she'll come up looking really well. But yeah, I think we'll have to...
I'll give you a quick look in the hangar.
Yeah, good idea. We'll do that. But this is part one of what are we going to make this a 10-part series. Yeah. I think that'll probably see us through. You've got Alison
to go too.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, next time I have to find some more microphones so we can get a few people. And then we'll have to arrange getting a few of you fellas together all at once and put a bottle of something in front of us and then we'll all leave.
Nah, you're 30 years too late for that.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, now you sort of give up that part of life.
We'll try with hot tea then.
Yeah.
No, jolly good. Thank you very much, everybody. We shall see you soon.